You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. I just wanted to mention, as I have, because I'm proud of it, the fact that our bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop, has just won an award for the best bookshop in Philadelphia. And we also won an award for the best non-corporate coffee shop on the main line, which is somewhat of an arcane award, but I'll take it. Today, our guest is Nathan Filer, whose first novel, The Shock of the Fall, was the winner of the coveted Costa Book of the Year Award. Coveted is always...
Which is a corporate coffee shop, actually.
So. Oh, yeah, that's right, it is. Wow, okay, that's the end of our show then. well, and the word coveted has always struck me as an interesting word. It's like a murder of crows. I always imagine a bunch of authors gathered around ready for the puck to be thrown so they can jump in and grab at it because it's coveted. Well, sorry, I get distracted, so you can pull me back. In any event, the book was published by St. Martin's Press. It's not supposed to be released till January, but it's available. It's kind of available. Well, let me ask you. Well, welcome, Nathan. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, and hello.
Tell me a little bit about the history of the book, because in the inside it says previously published as, and what was the former title?
In the U.S., it was published first as Where the Moon Isn't.
And the Shock of the Fall is such a better title, don't you think?
I think I do actually. I need to be careful. I think the American publishers did a good job for the right reasons. But I think The Shock of the Fall kind of it captures the book a bit better in my eyes. Yeah.
Well, how did that come about anyway? Because it's unusual. It's an unusual kind of thing to have one title switch it over.
Is it unusual? I mean, the more I hear, because we've been lucky to sell in lots of foreign territories, and it does seem to have different titles depending on where in the world it's being published. There's lots of moon themed titles across Europe. Italy's got a moon theme title, and then there's sort of the shock themed titles as well. So I'm sort of waiting for The Shock of the Moon to complete the collection. I think of it as The Shock of the Fall. And I think that's what it's being released as in paperback in the U.S. as well.
Well, after having done 160 interviews in 4 years and after having an independent bookstore, two things. Publishers are right about titles and publishers are right about covers, because as many times as I say you can't judge a book by its cover, every single person who comes into my bookstore does exactly that.
And that's what they're doing. But do you think publishers are right about it? I think that... there's not a secret ingredient, is there, or this sort of magic formula in order to get the perfect cover. I was thinking of Gone Girl, which I'm guessing is pretty huge there, as it has been here, and it's such a simple cover, really, isn't it? And then they do sort of the whole back catalogue with that kind of cover again. So I think there's a lot of guesswork and some hitting this.
Well, you know, it's funny because I interviewed Jojo Moyes, and it's not only is it big here, it's huge here. We've been selling it for 4 years, and it took so long to go to paperback. It was so popular, and now the movie's coming out. But you're right. All of her backstock, which never...
It's Gillian Flynn, not Jojo.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I hear your Jojo Moyes interview as well.
Yeah. Jojo Moyes, that's because... I thought of that because all of her covers look exactly the same, too. But, yeah, Gillian Flynn, they did the same thing. In fact, I saw a big billboard, actually, in Britain that showed all of her previous novels as well. So, I don't know. I just think that they are looking at the bottom line, and I think they're pretty good at guessing what people will like. That's all I was saying, kind of.
I think you're right, and I think you've got a nice looking one here. In the UK, they've just released a sort of seasonal edition, so there's some snowflakes on it now. Just to one assume might be a slightly cynical attempt to try and capture the Christmas market.
But it's a real Christmas story, very Christmassy story, very uplifting. Well, actually, okay, let's talk about the book. I mean, it's a book about guilt, sickness, the love and tragedy between two brothers and how one copes with his actions, which are irredeemable, unirredeemable or not, and sometimes, you know, he can't cope with them. Nathan, you come at the book from an interesting perspective. Tell our readers a little bit about your history and your profession and how that kind of coincides with the subject of the book.
Yeah, sure. Well, I worked as a mental health nurse for many years. I mean, I worked in mental health in different roles, so as a untrained nurse, and then I did my training and registered and worked as a nurse in acute psychiatric settings, and then worked in mental health research at the University of Bristol near to where I live. So I've had lots of roles in mental health, and of course that's a feature of the book. I'm always cautious. I never myself think of it as a book about mental illness, and the conversations around it often go that way, and I understand why, because parts of it are set in psychiatric ward, and because Matthew probably has schizophrenia, although he's not diagnosed in the novel, and I think that becomes an area that maybe is interesting to talk about or a hook to talk about, but I've never, like, when I was writing, I didn't consider it to be about that. I think of it as a story about a family, really, coming to terms with loss.
Well, it's funny because we spoke a little bit before about spoilers, and I'm not spoiling the book because Matthew portends in the first chapter what will come, not in great detail, but the nature of what's going to happen with regard to his brother Simon, who has Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And
although you don't discover that in the first chapter,
but you do discover
quite a lot, and it was an interesting exercise. I try and think why did you do it now, but I thought it was because I wanted the book to read as a page turner, because I love page turners, and to have an element of suspense around it. But Matthew talks about it at any given time. Like, a central part of the book, as you know, is that he's physically writing his story. So he's writing this story, and what he decides to put on the page is sort of influenced by what's going around for him at the time. And I just felt like when people start to tell their stories, we go to the interesting bit, don't we? And he sort of does that. He says, you know, here's the interesting thing that kind of happened, and then I had the task of still trying to maintain the suspense and to keep the reader's interest. I suppose that is suspense, though, isn't it? You give a bit at the beginning, you give enough, and then hold a bit back.
Yeah, and it does make it a page turner. If you were a complete nitwit, you might go to the end of. Some people go to the end of the book, but I would never do that.
I think, doesn't he say that somebody does that? Doesn't he say that Nanny New always reads the last?
Oh yeah, right. That's right.
That's because that's what my mother does. My mother, whenever she has a book, she turns to the last page and reads it to see whether she thinks it's got the right end note for her, and then she'll read it.
That's what my 92-year-old mother does too, with large print books. So funny. Well, the thing that's interesting is that at times your book doesn't really have a fourth wall, because Matthew's talking to the reader and saying, oh, I'm a bit repetitious. This, you know, I'm a bit cut and paste kind of guy. And so he's telling you who he is, which is really strange because, you know, he has this diagnosis of a slithery type disease, yet he's able to convey what he's doing and have some perspective about the condition that he's in, which is unusual.
Yeah, well, and yeah, he's got lots of insight, really, and he's he's an intelligent young man, and I think that, you know, having an illness as he does, it doesn't preclude that. You can absolutely still be intelligent, and he's got a kind of very natural intelligence, and I think as well, like, because we talk about all the that it's about loss and grief and this is a big part of it, but I sometimes think that makes it sound heavier than it is, because the other thing I think he's got is like quite a sharp humour and quite a wry take on the world, which again, you know, I think so he's got this illness, but it certainly doesn't define him, you know, and so he can be a bit of a joker as well.
Yeah, and it doesn't preclude him from being articulate in the slightest. But if you look at the book and the characters, all of whom are really well painted, even as the interview says, I guess it's Aunt Jacqueline who comes, even, you know, she's only there for a paragraph, yet you know who she is. But everybody's... This might not sound right, but it seems like everybody suffers in this book, from the little girl with the doll to Simon, of course, Matthew's parents, especially his father, maybe even more than his mother. His mother's got her own issues, but and then Nanny New, who is really a wonderful heroine for the book, and even the healthcare professionals, and maybe because of your past history, when their funding is cut and when they try to help Matthew and he refuses to, in a very material way, basically answer the door to their, you know, pleas. And so, but then, okay, then I still kind of at the end, especially the last few scenes, and again the girl, I do kind of feel uplifted, even though... Okay, I won't go any further than that. But I do feel uplifted, and I guess the question is what he did, is what happened non-redeemable? Or am I being a...
Well, I mean, life carries on for him, doesn't it, after the book. I really appreciate that, and you're being very careful not to do any spoilers, which makes it difficult to talk about a book. But I think that really, I'm pleased, yeah, that you said that you felt uplifted, because I want readers to, at the end, because it is, you know, there is heavy stuff that goes on there. And you're right, everyone does suffer. And I surprised myself sometimes with quite how much, because I think I'm, you know, I try to be a pretty happy guy as best I can, and you know, I don't like to see suffering, and yet everyone does suffer in it. And I think that you know, that's because at the heart of it there is a loss and there is an illness, and that means in life people do suffer. These aren't nice positions to be in. You know, some of your listeners will have illnesses like this. Some of your listeners might care for people who do, you know, be mothers or brothers or sons or daughters of people with very serious mental illness, and it's a tough role to be in. And so I think to you know, I couldn't do a rose-tinted picture of that, but that doesn't mean that there's no hope or no possibility of hope or uplifting moments. And sorry, my throat's going a little bit. I'm terribly full of cold. I don't know what the weather's like there. It's pretty cold in Philadelphia as well, is it?
Our image
it's
horrible.
It's all kind of snowy. That it's just turned here, and I've got a 2-year-old daughter who we drop off at nursery 2 days a week, and she picks up all the germs and all the snot and brings them back, and she seems fine, and it just knocks me to six. In terms of the kind of uplifting ending, as an author, as the author of this book, I had to make a decision there, and I suppose I thought, why not? You know, I've written this quite tough book, and it is my choice. I can end on a downer, or I can kind of lift things up a bit and show the I guess the goodness of people, and that there is some hope for this situation. So I think that was important in any case to offer some light and shade.
Well, it's funny because and you are an optimistic person, because you know, I listened to your TED talk about how to become a best-selling author, which was somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but you gave some great advice, and you could tell just from watching you and your body language and looking at you that you are a happy, optimistic person. And
I have my moments. We
yeah,
all have
course.
Our moments, don't we?
Well, one example in my life is there was this doctor in my town. He delivered my daughter, and he was driving, and this kid like rode his bike directly in front of him, and he hit the kid and killed him. And this was on a Friday, and it wasn't his fault. He couldn't have possibly helped himself. And then the following Monday, he was back at work, working, saving people's lives, delivering babies. And I was wondering, how would I feel? What would I do if I was in that situation? And I would be a total basket case. I would have been in bed. I would have been blaming myself for everything, even though I wasn't at fault. And I think maybe in your life you meet maybe 5 or 6 bodhisattvas, or whatever you want to call them, that don't resonate. They just are who they are. And so they recognize what their actions were and don't spend the rest of their life reliving, as Matthew does in part, what they think was something that ruined their life.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it casts a long shadow over him, doesn't it? And I'm, you know, the real life example you gave, I mean, that's just heartbreaking, isn't it, really?
And
of course, we write these things in fiction, and of course, there are people who this is their real life experience, isn't it? So, God, I mean, I don't know how I would, I've got no idea how I would cope in a situation like that. I think in writing the fictional version of that kind of situation, I didn't set out to make it a book about anything. Like I didn't really have a plan for it. So I didn't set out to have this family kind of locked in this grief response. And it was really, when I knew that I was going to put it plainly, I knew I was going to kill Simon, the big brother. Very early on, he dies right at the beginning. So I knew that grief would, of course, be a part of that. But when you set out to write a book, it's hard to know like how much these things will take a hold. And so I kind of thought, well, you know, so he'll die in chapter one, and so clearly chapter two will be about grief, and you know, half of chapter three is gonna have to be about grief, and there'll be a callback to grief in chapter seven, and it's not unreasonable to think in this way because you're trying to sort of work out a book before you've written it. But as I started to write it and get closer to those characters, and particularly say to the character of Matthew's mum, who's lost her little boy, you know, she's lost her son, and like it never felt like the right time to let that go. Like her life wasn't a bit disrupted by the loss of her son. It was shattered by it, and so of course the grief stayed, and because she handles it, I don't want to say badly because that feels cruel, but I guess she doesn't handle it as well as I'm sure she would have liked to, and so of course it has this huge knock-on effect on the remaining son, doesn't it?
So that answers that question, but here's an interesting thing, because Matthew does have this really, really strange coping mechanism. Simon at times manifests himself in Matthew's world in different ways. Again, being careful how I say that. But Matthew has a coping mechanism that was grounded, that was born in school.
I'm waiting to hear what you're going to say. I can't think what this is. Yeah.
Okay, well, in school, he has a science teacher who explains, explain to our listeners about how we all may contain atoms of Einstein or atoms of Shakespeare.
It was one of my clever friends who told me this anyway, but I think it's a generally accepted fact, isn't it, that sort of atoms get the very smallest parts of us get shared around rather than destroyed. So at any given time, we probably got some atoms in us that belonged to Stone Age man and that belonged to Pavarotti and that belonged to, you know, I don't know where that example came from. But you and I have probably shared some atoms at some point.
So, well, the thing is, the teacher says, you know, there's more atoms in the human body than there are stars in the universe. And then that number, which is an immense number, is a number that stays in Matthew's head throughout the book. And he utilizes it as a lattice, a structure in which he can attempt to, I don't know, reincarnate his brother. And then he actually does things in his apartment, and they're discovered initially by Nanny New, who's his grandmother, who's a sweetheart. But he's trying to accomplish a goal, and I'll let you say as much as you want about what he's trying to accomplish.
Well, now you're making me do the spoiler.
Right.
You've led me into doing the spoiler. So
yeah.
I've got no way back. The number is 7.4 times 10 to the power of 27, and it's the number of atoms in a sort of in an average human body, and it's a number that sort of keeps appearing through the book, doesn't it? In its long form of 7400000. Well, I won't read. They keep going, don't they? So. And it becomes, I don't know how that becomes an obsession for Matthew, but it becomes a kind of almost a solace for him, really, this science lesson that he got as he becomes unwell and starts to think that though his brother's gone, that in a sense he still exists, and he exists in him in a very literal way. Now, of course, actually, many people who have spiritual beliefs believe something like this anyway, don't they? Through that people live on in our hearts and so forth, or maybe live on in some other sort of realm. So I guess Matthew's views are perhaps no stranger than that. Actually, it's just he had this science lesson at what was a very crucial time in his in his life, and when he was feeling very vulnerable, and when he was starting to become unwell, and he just kind of held onto that lesson, and then when he becomes much more unwell, years later, he starts to make Simon, I suppose, doesn't he? He becomes unwell, and he tries to he's got this sense of the atoms, and he tries to. To rebuild him in a sense, in a very chaotic way at that time.
And we were talking about Matthew's intelligence, and even though what he's doing, and it's a good plot device you use, and it's very plausible, you could never do this actually in the place where you used to work. He wouldn't have the materials in which to do what he does. But because he's back in a flat, he's able to actually do the thing in real life that he thinks will bring him salvation and bring him his brother. And
well, this is because he's able to, because Nanny knew. I think you called her a sweetheart, didn't you? She's certainly a good one, isn't she? Like, with all of the, like, she felt like such a gift to Matthew. In an early draft, she existed just in a couple of paragraphs, and then I felt like I was giving him such a hard time.
Yeah,
that it was really nice to be able to give him Nanny New and give him this grandmother who's based on both of my grandmothers, actually. She was a gift to him, but also she gives him a gift, and she gives him this typewriter, doesn't she? So, and it really freed up the narrative for me, because as I said, because he's physically writing his story, unlike lots of first person narratives where we accept the words land on the page, just straight from the protagonist's head. In this case, he is writing his story out. He's got access to a computer at a day center. He prints out the pages, and so the construction of that, if you like, becomes a part of the narrative. But it started to present a problem for me, because I felt, well, you know, he's not the kind of person who's going to continue to adhere to his treatment plan. He's not the kind of person who's going to, you know, keep going into the day center every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday as prescribed. It just didn't feel right for his character. He's definitely got a bit of a rebellious streak, and I think rightly so. So when the decision that Nanny knew would give him a typewriter really opened everything up for me, because it meant that he could abscond, he could go home, he could lock himself in his flat, which he does, and he starts to work on this typewriter. And at that point, he's not taking his medication, he's not engaging at all with the support networks around him. More importantly, he's not engaging with his the kind of main support networks of his family, of his grandmother, and at that point is when he gets very poorly and starts to starts to kind of rebuild his brother.
Well, the thing that was striking to me and made me like Matthew more, and you already know I like Nanny New, is that she never judged him. And like when she's cleaning up after the situation we briefly discussed, when she's cleaning up and doing all this work, she never judges him. And it's so funny the way she sneaks her cigarettes in his flat. I really like that part. And also Matthew, the reason I like this part is because he'll snap at her when he tries to keep her out, but then he always regrets it, and he always admits to us out loud, essentially, you know, I shouldn't have done, I'm not, you know, this is not right, I don't. And then he apologizes, and that's a really, and I guess that's one of the reasons why there's this uplift.
Well, they love each other.
Yeah, they love each other.
They really like. He has a very. I mean, I guess he loves his mum as well, but he has such a difficult relationship with his mum. But his grandmother he loves her, and she just loves him. And so, I think he says, you know, he's sort of in terms of kind of letting himself, like, you know, removing himself from the family. I think he says, you know, he wouldn't give a shit if it wasn't for Nanny New, but he does feel guilty when he as you say, when he sort of he more than snaps at her, really, doesn't he? I think he kind of breaks her heart in that moment.
But she mends it. She as well as Matthew, she's strong enough to understand. But then again, if you look, his mother, sometimes I set her aside because he says she's mad at the beginning of the book, and I just take that as a given. But the father, who's really a wonderful guy, he just can't handle this and calls him mon ami, but then in another incident we haven't even talked about, then he says he's ashamed of his son. But then when he's repainting the walls in the flat, he does something that kind of, I don't know, almost, it did, like, bring a tear to my eye, because the way he writes on the wall, and it's like, you know, but he doesn't know what to do, but he just knows that he wants to be there, he just doesn't quite know exactly how.
He doesn't know how, does he? He's lost, and I had kind of mixed feelings about him when writing it, really, because I feel, when he, you know, goes there and writes that on the wall, and, like, you know, clearly he wants what's best for his son. I feel like if I'm going to be less charitable to him, I feel like he had a responsibility to intervene. Like, he could see that his wife was, you know, he could see that she, you know, she was unwell and she wasn't getting things right, and this was damaging to Matthew, and yet he doesn't really do anything, does he? He doesn't do anything, and I feel like it's, you know, it would have been tough to do it, and he doesn't know how. But, you know, if it's not his responsibility, then kind of who's in it? So, but the in terms of him being a good guy, they all are, aren't they? And that was really important to me when writing it. I wanted to write a book that had no villains. Like, there's lots of characters, like, every single character is flawed, and probably none more so than, well, I mean, but you know, I guess Matthew's mum has some very big flaws, but very good reasons. But the health professionals are very flawed, aren't they? You know, there's Click Click Wink, who's a bit, I'm going to use a swear word, man. I don't know if I can do that on your show.
you can say it, I'll just bleep it out. You just tell me that.
Yeah, no, you're going to insert your own swear word. But you know, Denise, the community nurse, she's a bit sort of overbearing and sort of mumsy. I was just going to say that Steve's a bit of a dick. That's not too bad.
But Steve is, I think Matthew's unfair to Steve. I mean, okay, he winks, and maybe he thinks the wink is kind of, you know, condescending, but then he does give him things that give him tools that he would not have otherwise, right?
It's true. And see, you can think he's unfair, but we have to remember that, of course, Matthew is giving you all of that information as well. So I think Matthew's not especially unfair to Steve, because he's telling the whole story. So he says the way that Steve's bad, but it is also Matthew who's revealing the ways that Steve's good. And I guess that comes back to the point that I was making there, that there are flawed characters, but there's not sort of baddies. And like, I work, as we said earlier, I worked as a nurse for 15 years, working as a nurse in mental health. And I made mistakes as a nurse. I was by no means the perfect health professional. I would go to work sometimes and be, you know, tired and annoyed and all of the range of feelings that you would feel over working so many years in a job. And so I didn't always get it right, and I saw colleagues not always get it right. What I didn't see were kind of villains, you know, like people like outright trying to kind of ruin people's lives. And I think there can be a temptation perhaps when you know, it might have been easy to do that, to polarize the cast, and to, you know, because Matthew doesn't want to be treated. He doesn't want to be in this system, and so it perhaps would have been an easier thing to write him as seeing them as villains. But I think, like, he's I wanted to make him more nuanced than that, I suppose, and And again, like, he's intelligent enough to see the people, hopefully, for what they are.
Yeah, and, you know, that brings me to a question I would never have thought of asking, but every author is asked it in a first-person narrative, which is Matthew an unreliable narrator?
I mean, of course he is. I mean, the unreliable narrator thing, I always think, I try and think of a character who isn't, really. Like, actually, to think of a person who isn't, because I'm certainly an unreliable narrator of my life. I'll, you know, depending on how I feel, I'll reflect upon the past differently. I can think about the same moment in totally different ways, depending on the mood I'm in. I will put a different slant on a story depending on who I'm telling and, you know, what impact I want that to have. And you know, of course.
Suppose this, and it will become a book club book, and it will be we have our own book clubs at the store, so this will become a book club book. And what if you're Skyped in?
Your award-winning store.
Yeah, thank you. I always forget that. So if we have it there at the book club and you were kind enough to Skype in or something like this, and some old biddy says, well, I don't even think there was a Simon. I just think Matthew was making the whole thing up. Does she have every right as anybody else to, I mean, it could be, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose I think that I don't think of him as unreliable in that way, and that I think he's telling his truth. So, as far as I'm concerned, Simon is as much as a fictional character can. But I think, Matthew's trying to get to the truth, almost like fanatically. You know, he's so determined to get it right and tries to explain when he might not be. So I think he's trying to, but he's, you know, he is unwell. He is psychotic. His reality is really quite distorted. And so, if all of us are unreliable, then perhaps inevitably he has to be, doesn't he?
Well, another question, you know, that's one question. And the other question, which half the authors get really angry at and half of them don't.
It's the same old lady who's going to be asking this question, because I don't like her.
No, she won't ask this because she's not going to know what I'm talking about. They'll ask you, well, is your novel in the slightest magical realism? Because they always want to go back to 100 Years of Solitude or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny. Of course your book is not magical realism, but, and again, treading very carefully here, in the beginning of the book, there's an incident with a girl, and she does something, and it affects Matthew in a very strange way, and it also deals, in my opinion, causatively with what happens regarding Simon. And it's almost as if, especially in the end when you have musically your return, it almost seems like magic in a way, black magic. It has some of the elements of black magic, actually.
Well, that's really interesting. And the
she's there at the end, and she is almost like a. I don't want to talk about it because I'll give it.
It's an interesting point. I'll be interested in if it does become a bookshop. A book group book, because like the Return of Annabelle is something that that's the name of the little girl who's there at the beginning and comes again at the end, and it is something that that comes up in conversations. Now, if I can confess to you, it's my least favourite part of the book, the Return of Annabelle, and I think if I was going to do one thing differently, if I rewrote it, I possibly wouldn't have her come back, even though she does serve an important purpose there, but it felt
the reason why it's good is because nobody would ever have expected it, and secondly, because
don't we expect a character at the beginning of a book to come back and justify their place on the page
in the Charles Dickens way? Yes, but not, I don't think, in this context. Plus, she's as equally flawed as everybody else could be and shares some of the characteristics of the main protagonist. And it's like, this is how it began. She was quite angry, and she was angry. It was ruined. And then there's a certain dispensation at the end, and I thought
it's interesting that she doesn't share any of that memory. She doesn't like this thing that's haunted him for so long, was just one of a series of. Again, it's really difficult to talk about it, like giving things away, isn't it? But it hadn't stayed with her in the same way, and actually, that event meant something very different to her. She did provide me like a bit of a eureka moment because I thought, oh, is it contrived that I'm bringing her back?
But when not at all. She was nice. I mean, she did something she didn't have to do at the end, and it was very kind, I thought.
Why I'll allow myself it is because when she says, when she talks about the memorial, so we'll be very cryptic now for people, but when she kind of makes that suggestion, I didn't sort of know how the book was going to end because I didn't plan it, and actually. Once she makes this kind of suggestion and like Matthew suddenly has his idea of what he wants to do, I had that idea at the same moment as he did. So I was pleased I brought her back for that reason. She helped me write the end of the book.
Oh, you know what? The book does not have an end. Sorry.
Well, it's there's an openness to it, isn't there? But there's a moment of closure for Matthew.
Some people like their books. And I've said this before on the show, they like them wrapped up and with a ribbon in the box and all that. And I like much better when it's the way you end your book because the reader still has to work after finishing the book. And I also ask this question, which is, you know, when you're done, when you let your little boy, your son out into the world, do you feel like, oh, I really don't want to let go of this? Were you happy to let go of it? Were you happy to have... give it to the world, or did you have some reservation about that?
That's a really good question. I mean, I let it go a while ago now, of course, because the US is behind in the publishing schedule to over here in the UK. So I do have distance from the book now, which is kind of welcome to me in a sense. I mean, I love it. It's really nice to be able to talk about it now, and it makes me think about it again. And it's nice that it's an immediate thing for you. But I've let Matthew go now, and it did take a while. When you write in this kind of first person voice, and then you're trying to write other stuff, and it's like, oh God, I'm so used to speaking in that way, so it took a little while to shake it, but he's gone now. He's doing his own thing. We might nod if we passed each other in the street.
Well, so how come? All right, he has his typewriter, so you use the font that would be a courier type, semi courier type font, and then he has his little drawings. And what decided you to make this a book that had that? Because obviously most books don't have that. There's a picture of a typewriter, and there's a picture of his tooth with, you know, a problem with it. And did you draw them also?
No, I didn't draw them. I can't draw. Actually, there was a friend of our family's did the first sketches, and then so I worked very closely with an artist, and then actually they weren't used because. The publishers get to make these kind of decisions, and so they got someone else in to do them. So I don't know. I'm a bit less interested in the drawings now, really, since I think I had a slightly different vision for them at the beginning. But in terms of the other stuff, like the typewriter pages and so forth, it comes back again to the Matthew's physically writing down this story. He's building up a stack of pages, and he leaves this stack of pages somewhere, doesn't he? At the end of the book, and that's how I always saw it in my mind. I was creating that kind of stack of dog-eared, loose-leaf pages, these sketches, kind of that were a lot kind of rougher, and they were just thrown in there as well, and it was stacked up, and there were typewriter bits and bits printed and. And so that's how I saw the book. But as my publisher pointed out, you can't actually sell that loose stack of pages in Barnes and Noble. So from that point, it's always going to be a compromise. And I think it's why I struggled with the title as well, because there's all these different titles, but that was partly because I struggled to think of a title to begin with, because all the time I was writing it, Matthew was telling this story, but he wasn't writing a novel. You know, he was never going to give it a title and have that on the cover. So all of my decisions have been based on getting close to his character. And then when we had to package it as a book, it suddenly felt like a very different thing.
It's interesting because, well, first of all, I mean, Matthew was a good artist anyway, but it's interesting when you read the reviews sometimes, and other people have told me who have read the book, you know, some people compare it to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, especially in the way he handles his medication. Others have compared it many times to Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. And I like Robert Cormier's book, I Am the Cheese. I don't know if you've read it, but...
I haven't, no.
You would like that, I Am the Cheese. It's very sad. Well, it would be a spoiler if I told you what it was, but it's really good. You should write it down, I Am the
I'm
Cheese.
I'm going to look that up. I've just written it down.
And then what happens then is that some people might intimate that, is this on the verge of being young adult fiction, which is not a bad thing, but is it something that you would recommend that some 16 or 17-year-old, precocious or not, person read?
16 or 17, yes. Straight up, I would, because quite a few 16 and 17-year-olds have got in touch with me, and it's been really interesting to hear their thoughts on it. And I think it's a book that does speak to people of that age. It wasn't marketed. Have I lost you a bit there?
That was me. I was fiddling with the telephone cord. Sorry.
Where shall I go back to? 16 or 17.
Yeah,
I would, because 16 and 17-year-olds have gotten in touch with me, who've read it, and it was never marketed to that age group here. So the sort of the young adults who've read it, they've discovered it themselves, and so I guess maybe they're that might not make them a general sample, you know. I guess they're the kind of young people who really are looking out for books and who love reading. But I've been really heartened by the response of people that age, and I think Matthew does speak to them. I guess, you know, he's not that much older. He's 19 himself, isn't he? A bit of a disaffected youth himself. So I suppose that could certainly speak to people of that age. Probably not too much younger. I was never thinking of an age group audience when I was writing it. These are all things that I've kind of learned since, you know, and now I think of how books are marketed and all of that stuff because I've been thrown into the sort of, you know, the publishing world. But I wasn't thinking about that. I had no idea the kind of age group I was aiming for. I was just writing a story that was interesting to me.
Totally off topic, but one of the things I love, you know, obviously having an independent bookstore in the United States, you're not going to be making a fortune. That's not why I'm doing it. But
nice.
Some of the things that I like the best about the books, well, I like everything, but some of the things I like the best, and if you look at our website for Wellington Square Bookshop, you'll see the pictures, is like when a young girl is in one of our chairs curled up and she's reading Moby Dick, or someone's reading Henry James. And they're like 14 or 15 years old. And it reminds me when I was that age. And it's just, don't you think that's a wonderful feeling?
Well, I mean, it really is, isn't it? And I think that there has been a shift in YA over the past, over the past few years now, where, you know, like teenagers are not to be talked down to, are they? You know, these are, you know, they're a very intelligent readership, and you know, our life is no less sort of complicated at that age, and the big themes of life are equally important to young people. So and of course, you know, there's a huge, I, you know, the Fault in Our Stars, I guess that's probably, yep, huge over there, is it? Yep. It was absolutely massive here, and you know, that's pretty heavy stuff, isn't it? You know, it's not a light read, and it's not a fantasy read, and it's not and yet clearly it struck a chord with a huge number of young people.
Yeah, my daughter was 12 years old when she read it, and it definitely did. And I was thinking when I read it, I was thinking, well, do you really want to expose someone to that much poignancy, sadness, at that age? But they seem to handle it very well, and they seem to understand it, and I think it gives them a lot of insight. And then what you were talking about young adults, I mean, whether you love Harry Potter or not, my heroine is J.K. Rowling, because she created millions and millions of readers that wouldn't have been readers.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's definitely changed, and for the better. And you know, I don't want... In my profession, I obviously don't want people to put it on their Kindle or on their iPad, but I really don't care. As long as they're reading, it's fine with me. So, but what's good about a bookstore is that it's not like Amazon recommendations. If you're in my used book section and you're looking for a book, you're also going to see the book on the left of it and the right of it, and one of those books might be the book that changes your life. So.
Absolutely, yeah. And you can pick it up and leaf through the pages and give it a sniff, and it smell like a new book, and you'll even look across and you might meet someone and have a conversation. There's a lot to be said for bookstores.
Yeah, and that was the whole idea, was, you know, a place where, and that's why there's so many seats and couches and benches, so that, and the coffee shop, is so that you can
and an award winning coffee shop.
Will you stop it, please? I already said it. I knew you were going to do that. Well, maybe we just, let's end it on that note, because now I'm just talking about myself.
Well, I hope that my book has a happy home in your bookshop, and thanks very much for having me on the show.
Sure, and if you ever get over this way, or when your next novel is out, let me talk to you again if you're not sick of me.
Well, and I'd be delighted to. And actually, I will get over that way. I should say in January I'm going to be at not in Philadelphia, but a book festival, the Rancho Mirage Festival in Palm Springs in California. So if anyone's passing through there in late January, then I'll be there talking about the book.
You picked a lovely pace where you have a very nice socioeconomic demographic and beautiful climate.
Right, I know nothing about it. It sounds quite posh anyway.
Oh, it is very posh. Yes, that's very nice.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and best of luck. Well, the book already is, as you said in TED, you've even said yourself, it's a bestseller, and I'm looking forward to your next work. So thanks again.
Thanks ever so much. Thank you.
Well, Nathan Filer, author of The Shock of the Fall, winner of the 2013 Costa Book of the Year Award. It's an excellent book. As I said, it's been compared to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, I Am the Cheese by Robert Cormier, one of my favorite books. But it is not a young adult book. It's a very cerebral book in so many ways, especially because it deals with mental illness, and it deals with either what you conclude are irredeemable or redeemable actions that someone's taken at an early age and that live on and on in your life. But anyway, great book. So next week, Rebecca is always scheduling. We have some people now we're scheduling. So our upcoming interviews include Emma Hooper's new book, Christina Baker's new book. Actually, it's Christina Baker Klein, and S.M. Hulse. And if you want to look at a complete schedule, you can visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com, WCHA1520.com, or simply download our podcasts at iTunes or Podomatic. So as always, thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to presenting to you another great author next week.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.